Hello, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we got special guest Alan Rule. That is how you pronounce it, right?
Yep.
Awesome. And he's a subject matter expert on the Crusades, and he comes highly recommended by a friend of the channel, particularly because he's very familiar with the primary sources of the era. So we're going to have a nice discussion about the Crusades, and as I wait for us to actually get live on YouTube, because there seems to be a delay there. But anyway, so a lot of talk about the Crusades lately. A lot of it was started by James White. But in all fairness to James White is responding to the fact that, you know, for quite a while now, evangelicals, and particularly of the Reformed persuasion, have been nonetheless, you know, celebrating and lauding the Crusades as an effort to, you know, fight Islam. And I think they've actually undersold the usefulness of the Crusades, because I don't think most people, and it doesn't sound like James White was aware that there were more than four Crusades, given his Twitter comments. But there were also Crusades, and, you know, they're called the Livonian Crusades, that fought in the northern Europe. So a lot of different Crusades that happened, not just in the Holy Land, and, you know, not just four either. So we're gonna, you know, have a bit of an expert opinion weigh in on the situation now. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing all right. I'm happy to be talking about history. It's my favorite topic. So and the Crusades is something I've been studying for a long time. So yeah, I'm happy to help you and your viewers out.
So I'm also, you know, something of a history buff myself. So yeah, I got some questions that will be, you know, hopefully not too in the weeds, but you know, it's just whatever. What I watch usually on my spare time on YouTube is, you know, a lot of more either history or just pop culture, sports escapism. You know, there's not a whole, not as much in between. I do watch, you know, people like John Harris and stuff like that, but for the most part, you know, I'm trying to escape, you know, just learn more about history, ancient or medieval battles and stuff like that. So the Crusades, I've definitely watched a lot of content on YouTube regarding the Crusades and stuff like that. So first question, because get a little bit more about your background. You say that you're a traditional Catholic. I kind of want to get a gauge for what that means.
Okay, I've been Catholic my whole life. I do call myself a traditional Catholic, if you look at my account on X. But, like, I'm not the kind of guy who's going to separate from the church, you know. Like, I don't attend an SXPX chapel. I attend a Latin Mass, but I attend the Latin Mass that's under the local bishop. I don't reject Vatican II. So, like, I'm not, like, certainly not a sedevacantist. So I don't know if that helps. I don't know how familiar you are with the certain camps of the traditionalist movement being.
Yeah, I know there's like Franciscans, Dominicans, and I don't think Jesuits would count as traditional. And I don't know if Augustinians are still a thing.
Well, those are groups. You can have a traditional, like a Franciscan who's a traditional, or a Dominican, but then you can have Franciscans and Dominicans who are both rank modernists too. So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. I don't know. I know we've had, you know, Eastern Orthodox on here, but I don't know how many Catholics I've had on the channel as guests before. So I just figured I'd ask while we have the opportunity. So the Crusades. So I guess the first question I have is about the Council of Chalcedon, specifically, you know, does issue some sort of ruling, if you would call it that, against the idea of warrior priests, the idea that it doesn't really allow for, you know, bishops to take up arms really for any reason. But it does seem like medieval church and medieval bishops did not necessarily agree with that. Now, and there's a very proud history within the church, even in Protestantism, Black Robe Regiment in the United States Revolution. There's a proud history of, bishops taking up arms, and, that does factor into the Crusades. I believe there are examples prior to the Crusades, but definitely that is a thing in medieval history. So what are your thoughts on, the Council of Chalcedon and their decision and how that should factor into the Crusades, if it does, or if it doesn't?
Okay. I'd have to see that Canon of Chalcedon, but in terms of clergy taking part in armed combat, that was when the Pope calls the First Crusade in 1095 in Clermont, there was no opposition to it. Like today there's opposition from Catholics who look back and it's like, yeah, we shouldn't have done that. But back then everyone did that. They all knew the Pope was doing that. But eventually they established the Crusader states. And you have specific groups like you had some bishops who fought in battles, like Bishop Adhemar, he fought in battles. And then you eventually have the monastic orders like the Templars. There was opposition to that from some sources. There's a guy named Walter Mapp who was against it. I got some of his stuff over there, who's a 12th century Englishman. And he's against the idea of like having like a kind of order that's like a monastic order, but you fight in it, specifically talking about the Templars. But there are examples of clergy being in battle in both East and West around the time of the schism. I got an account. I believe it's Ateliates, a Byzantine chronicler who chroniclers priests fighting in battle, like a Greek Orthodox priest. I guess it's 1040s. This is right before the schism. So, I mean, it was not unheard of. I'd have to see that Canon of Chalcedon. That's obviously way earlier in church history.
Right.
It's true that it was controversial to have clergy in battle.
All right. Now, I wanted to ask, would you consider the Reconquista, which arguably starts prior to the First Crusade, it starts in the late 700s, or early 800s. That often gets lumped in with the Crusades. Do you consider that, in part of the whole Crusades, or do you think that is completely itemized or separate?
Well, the first battle of the Reconquista was in about 718, the Battle of Covadonga. Like, that was in the northern region of Spain, Asturias. The Muslim invasion is halted, so they didn't ever conquer the northern regions of Spain. That was about 718 or so, 720-ish, around there. And then slowly they start to reel it back. And then the Crusades... A friend of mine, she asked me, are there any famous Spanish crusaders? I'm like, there's not a whole lot because they were kind of busy doing their own thing in Spain. In the 13th century, I think the year was 1212, there was a battle, like things in the Holy Land were kind of, stagnant. There was a period, there was no big battles going on. So the Templars were there in the Battle of Las Navas de Tolosa in 1212 was crusaders against the Almohad Caliphate, who was the caliphate in Spain at that time. And they were able to defeat the Muslims. And in that kind of crippled their power base. And in 1236, they take back Cordoba, and 1248 they took back Seville, and then at that time the Muslims were reduced to the very far south of Spain in Granada. So yeah, there was kind of some interplay going on with when things were pretty quiet in the Holy Land, the Templars went over and helped out in Spain. So yes, there should be part of it.
Yeah, because, you know, some would say that, you know, the Reconquista was more of a retroactive idea in terms of pairing with Spanish nationalism. But at the same time, there was always there had to have always kind of been a religious motivation for, you know, why Al-Andalus was an enemy of a Christian kingdom at the same time. So.
Yeah, that was certainly the case. Now, you talk about Spanish nationalism, like we kind of, they didn't have the same kind of nationalism back then, and they didn't have the same kind of identity as a Spanish. Like back right, then you had the Kingdom of Castile, the Kingdom of Aragon, the Kingdom of Navarre, and like that came together over time, specifically with Ferdinand and Isabella in the 15th century. And then you kind of get talks of Spain. So the terms kind of projected back onto them.
The term nationalism or the term Reconquista? I believe you're nationalism. Talking about nationalism.
Okay. Nationalism.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty interesting time in European history where you have a lot of, you know, states kind of, you know, high crown, there's higher crown authority than there used to be. And, you know, they're forming more of I don't want to say a national identity, but the idea that you're having a standardization of languages and legal structure. It's a pretty fascinating time, you know.
Yeah, and in that day, like in those days, you had some saintly, like if you're talking about the 1200s, you have some monarchs. King Ferdinand III of Castile. This is not the Ferdinand who got married to Queen Isabella. That's Ferdinand right. of Aragon. But Ferdinand of Castile was actually a saint, a Catholic saint, and he's the one that conquered... In 1236, he conquered Cordoba back from the Islamic Caliphate. And in the that time, you had like a whole bunch of like saint kings who were like in England, you had Edward the Confessor. He's a bit earlier. King Louis the Ninth of France, Saint Louis, the city in Missouri where is named after him. And Vladimir of Kiev, I guess he's the late 900s, but he's, you know, from that line of medieval kings. And like, it's a big difference at that time, the contrast between king, like a saint king, and like to be a king at that point was like, kind of like an occupational hazard for excommunication. There's a lot of kings that got excommunicated back then because of the way the church was in Europe, because we had the investiture controversy. Like for example, like you go over to the Byzantine Empire, if the king did something bad and the patriarch is trying to teach him a lesson, he just removes him, puts his friend as patriarch. You know, that's that happened a few times, right? You know, the church was the church was controlled by the state. In the West, the two were more separate. And so that's interesting because that kind of allowed the Crusades to happen, you know, offering the plenary indulgence for a knight and their vassals. And that was the first crusade. Eventually, in the second and third crusade, you have kings who go on crusades, take their armies for their kingdoms and stuff like that.
So let's kind of dive into what you just referenced there, because there is the accusation that, you know, Pope Urban II was offering salvation or selling salvation in a way to get people to, you know, join the crusade. Now, you mentioned plenary indulgence. Is that the right word?
Yeah. Okay. The idea.
My interpretation of an indulgence isn't necessarily like, I don't think the concept is wholly unbiblical, but I would agree with Martin Luther that you shouldn't be selling indulgences. I think not that the concept of an indulgence is entirely unbiblical, but the idea that, so is there a difference between, you know, this indulgence versus promising salvation, or
Well,
you know, is there a nuance that's missing in this conversation?
Yes, and it's not indulgence, if you think about it, has nothing to do with salvation. It's to do with time out of purgatory. I know as a Protestant, you probably have issue with purgatory, but back then it was firmly believed by all Christians, and it's a thing. You know, people like Pope Gregory have visions of purgatory. Those were influential in the medieval age. And then because it's a long, long time, a lot of people are going to be in purgatory. So the idea of an indulgence is time out of purgatory. It's not to do with salvation. Like if you go on a crusade and you commit a grave sin, you're going to hell, right? And you die without repenting of that sin, you're going to hell. Doesn't matter if there's an indulgence or not.
Okay, so, you know, that accusation kind of falls a little flat, that the Urban was promising salvation to fighters.
Yeah, like it's kind of like, because unfortunately a lot of people get their knowledge of the Crusades from this abomination of a movie called Kingdom of Heaven.
Okay, Ridley Scott.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen it.
I actually have not seen it, but I'm under the impression it's not very good. And Ridley Scott isn't exactly the most historic director. I mean, Gladiator is a fun movie and all, but let's not pretend like it's historically accurate, because Commodus was emperor for like 17 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then, you know, Napoleon's kind of been universally hated for its ahistoricism. But I've not actually seen Kingdom of Heaven, which I kind of heard was middle of the road, but.
Well, it's really good in terms of like effects and stuff. But like it takes place, it's not the first crusade. It takes place during the Crusader States. And basically they portray the king fairly well, but pretty much as soon as the king turns around, like the Templars are like trying to kill the Muslims raiding their caravans. Like, no, there was a lot of stability there. There's a few ugly episodes, but like there's a scene in Kingdom of Heaven where they're about to board the boats to sail to the Holy Land, where there's this clergyman preaching. It's like, whoever kills an infidel is guaranteed paradise and stuff. And I'm like, that's not what was preached. It's so simplistic, right? You know, I don't think these people have done any serious study of the Crusades, but I promise you that that movie has influenced a lot more people than any YouTube videos have. So,
yeah, YouTube seems to be pretty pro-Crusade. Like, even the videos were like, wow. I just kind of have an admiration for the Crusaders because they stuck out, you know. I kind of view Satan through everything he could at the Crusaders, and they still prevailed and, you know, took Jerusalem and stuff like that. You know, he threw everything he could at them, including some ugly episodes with dubious relics and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, that happened when they took Antioch. You know, they claimed to have found the spear that had
the Holy Lance.
Yeah, the Holy Lance. Although that was almost certainly a fake, because the Crusaders had seen the actual Holy Lance in Constantinople just a few months earlier. You know, so they were like, "Are you sure?" But like the person who claimed to have found it, I believe it was Peter the Hermit, who was a kind of a famous clergyman on the Crusade. He was like at that point things were pretty desperate. They didn't know if they were gonna make it.
So just to give some background, Antioch was like a siege. It lasted around 2 years, give or take. It wasn't the most competently executed siege, because I don't think they had the manpower to fully surround the city of Antioch, but you know, because they had to defend their eastern flank, and there's a lot of, you know, valiant efforts in doing that, like very audacious charges, cavalry charges that basically saved them from, you know, saved the crusade siege from being, you know, just overrun by a relief force. But it's a very long siege that puts the Crusades to the test. Because again, they didn't have the manpower, the resources to really conduct the siege.
And keep in mind, the like like now, like Antioch no longer exists now, but like back then, Antioch was huge. It was like New York City, like of that part of the world. It was a huge city. You had Constantinople, that was probably the biggest city in the area, and you had Antioch as a short second. And about 20 years earlier, it had come under Turkish control. Now, the Turk had split it into two groups. Turkish Empire had fractured and split into two groups.
There was a Fatimids, and if you want to go south, or are you talking about closer to Sultanate of Rum? And
yeah, I'm talking about the Sultanate of Rum and the Seljuk Empire.
Okay.
And they had, in the Battle of Nicaea and in the Battle of Derylium, they were fighting the Sultanate of Rum, whereas at Antioch, they're fighting the main Seljuk Empire. And so, of course, they hear rumors that I think it was Kurbega, that was the Turkish Seljuk leader, is bringing his army. So they need to take the city quickly so they can, as soon as they take the city, it's a lot easier to defend. But if they get a pincer move, they're finished. So they eventually bribe a guy on the wall to kind of let them in, you know, a Christian, I believe he was an Armenian. And so they basically open the gates and then they take the city. And then the Turkish army arrives. But the Turkish army was surprisingly shocked. The crusaders just went and charged them and they fled. Turns out the army was smaller than they thought it was going to be. And at this time, like, the Turkish power has been crippled. And so the Fatimids, who you talked about a moment ago in Egypt, are able to take Jerusalem and several parts of the Holy Land back from the Turks. And so
there's a lot of changing hands with the cities after the Antioch.
Yeah, because at that time, the Turks had loss after loss after loss. Because I don't think they were used to the fighting, the type of thing that came from the West. Like a huge armored knight on horse, the Frankish charge. They had not seen that before. And so they were kind of unequipped to fight against European knights. I mean, who wants to fight against a knight? Seriously, like, that's got to be a scary thing, right? Especially back then with all the armor and on the horse, and the horse has armor. So they did their damage to the Turks, and then they head down south to try to take Jerusalem, and they manage to. And of course, there's some people say, oh, as soon as, again, Kingdom of Heaven, they're like, oh, yeah, 100 years ago when the Crusaders took the city, they killed everyone inside the wall. That's not true. Yes, they did kill quite a few people, unfortunately. But the idea that they killed every single person inside the walls was, that's fake. It's not true at all. There was, I've read a couple chronicles on it, a couple primary sources. You know, you got Falter of Chartres. He talks about how a large group of the Muslims were allowed to leave. And this other guy, a clergyman on the crusade named Robert the Monk, he talks about how after they had taken the city, the crusaders made the surviving the Muslims take out the corpses of the dead Muslims. You can't do that if all the Muslims are dead, right? So, again, that's more fiction from Kingdom of Heaven. I know you haven't seen it. I prefer if you keep it that way. It's such an abomination of a movie.
So let's kind of rewind the beginnings of the First Crusade. Alexios Komnenos, that's how you pronounce it, right, is the emperor of the Eastern Romans or Byzantine Empire. Yep. He has a long preparation for this crusade. Like, he's been preparing for this for years. He's been trying to shore up his western flank and, you know, his other flanks and stuff like that. So the initial design of the First Crusade is supposed to be, you know, knights from the west are trying to help the Eastern Romans recapture some of their lost territory with the end goal of reestablishing Jerusalem under a Christian nation and its rule. So that is, you know, a correct understanding, correct? Or
yeah, well, in 1071, the Turks had defeated Romanos the Fourth Diogenes, who was the emperor. He was campaigning out in Anatolia in the summers of 68, 69. For the summer of 70, he sent a general. He had stuff to take care of. But in 71, he's back out there again in eastern Anatolia. His army gets defeated, and pretty soon, pretty much in the next few years, like all of Anatolia is overrun. It's under Turkish control now. So like all that farmland, like all the towns are now paying taxes to the Turks instead of paying taxes to Constantinople. So the revenue's drying up. And something else that's happening, the Byzantines, if you've ever studied Byzantine history, they're getting attacked by the Normans too. The Normans,
right?
They loved stealing Byzantine land. The Normans,
and they crushed the Normans crushed them like so much.
Yeah, they're.
I kind of view the Byzantines as like the Cleveland Browns of world empires. Like they're just always in a rebuilding year, and you know, even after Justinian's restoration, like it's immediately taken away by the plague. And it doesn't really last, you know, maybe it was Belisarius who was more to, you know, be credited with that. But they're always in a rebuilding year. And
well, the thing is, in the year 1000, the Byzantine Empire was huge. It had captured Antioch again. It had captured northern Syria. They would have probably gone all the way to get Jerusalem. So in 1025, you got Basil II, also known as the Bulgar Slayer. He dies in 1025. Then his brother Constantine VIII takes over for 3 years. And then you kind of have about 30 years of very bad emperors. But the empire can handle it because it's so large. But as soon as you have the Turks and the Normans, things start to go bad. I think in 1081, when Alexius Comnenus becomes emperor, he had 300 soldiers left in the whole empire. Like, he didn't have a lot left. There's no way you're taking Anatolia back with 300 soldiers. And so, like, he tries some stuff. He takes some troops along the coast, tries to raid the coast, captures a few towns there. You know, there's a great primary source called the Alexiad by Anna Comnena. That's the daughter of Alexius Comnenus. It's like a 500-page biography. You can, it's published by Penguin. You can go purchase it. Amazing book. I got mine over there. It's one of my favorite books from that era. And it talks about the Crusades as well. But yeah, so he's trying to get that. And then eventually that coincides with a bunch of pilgrims from the West going to Jerusalem and getting slaughtered. I know Peter the Hermit had gone on a pilgrimage earlier in his life, and he kind of escaped by the skin of his teeth. And so that kind of coincided with the First Crusade. Alexius Comnenus appeals to Pope Urban, and then he's like, okay, you know, let's get the idea of a crusade had been floated about by Pope Gregory the VII in 1064 in his letter to Henry the IV of all people. This was when they were on good terms before he excommunicated Henry the IV the first time. So the idea had been thrown around. But it was Urban II who eventually called it in Clermont. And then eventually the next year, the plan was to rendezvous at Constantinople, and they all did. There's like the Peasants' Crusade, which was
People's Crusade. And then,
yeah, like
mostly we focus on the Crusade of Princes, I believe it's called.
Yeah. But, now, in the First Crusade, there's no kings on the First Crusade. There's rich vassals like Raymond of Toulouse, you know, Bohemond of Toronto, who was actually the son of Robert Guiscard. He was one of the Norman leaders who was attacking the Byzantine Empire. So when he shows up in Constantinople, Alexius Comnenus was a bit nervous. He's like, ooh, you know. But, and so he makes them like swear oaths to them that, okay, if there's land that belonged to me, it comes back to me. And they were kind of uneasy about that, but they eventually decided to go along with it.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And so, yeah, then they start the crusade into Anatolia.
I just want to say, like, having a military that's capable of fighting the Seljuks, who, you know, Turks, very much a cavalry force, a light cavalry force, and then having that same military also be equipped to fight Normans, you know, just think, you know, how Vikings fight, very heavy infantry style. Like, that is that's a challenge to have a military be able to take on both of those threats. Like, that's a hard thing to equip.
Well, I don't think the crusade was specifically against
the no, Normans. I'm just saying, like, the Byzantine's military.
Like,
you know, just kind of, you know, appreciate the challenge that they faced. And then, you know, the People's Crusade ultimately comes to an end at Nicaea, correct? When, you know,
yeah, around there, they had
they were a little bit of a burden. And then,
yeah, well, they're kind of antsy in Constantinople. It's like, we want to get across, you know, and then they, and then they're like, okay, we'll ferry you across into the danger zone. And then they raid a couple forts, and then they're, but that, as soon as they come across a main Turkish force, they're completely wiped out. And the main body of the crusade, as soon as they come over, they're heading to Nicaea, and they see the pile of the People's Crusade, their pile of corpses there, and they kind of pay their respects to them. And it talks about that in the Chronicle of Fulcher of Chart. Like, as soon as they're going to Nicaea, and they see them. And then when the Turks fight the Crusaders at Nicaea, like, I think they kind of underestimated them. I think they were going to be more farmers with pitchforks, and they get a bunch of armored knights who they hadn't seen before, and they got completely owned. And then Nicaea, famous for the Council of Nicaea, of course, goes back to the Byzantine Empire. So. And stays with them until, I believe, 1333.
Quite some time.
So about 230 years. It's interesting, because if you ever want to talk about the Fourth Crusade and if it led to the fall of the Byzantine Empire, like, I got some primary sources on that as well, if you wanted.
Okay. I'm sure we'll get to that. Let's kind of wrap up the First Crusade first. Obviously, they're going through Anatolia. The Byzantines, I think, take more of a northern route to kind of mop up.
Like, they kind of come down the coast and just kind of take back all the land that the Turks had taken. And there's no Turks to oppose them, because the Crusaders have taken them out.
So the Crusade, you know, moves east. I believe one guy goes to Edessa. Establishes the First Crusader state. And then they go to Antioch, and the Byzantines get news that things have lost, so they kind of don't help them out. So yeah. what do the primary sources say about that?
Things were, like as you pointed out, the taking of Antioch was a super long siege. It took a long time. It took over a year, closer to two. So it's a long siege, and at one point it starts to look very hopeless. And the people start deserting the crusade. Then a guy named Stephen of Blois, and the whole time they're like, well, eventually the Byzantines will get down here and help us out, and they'll take the city. So a knight named Stephen of Blois goes back to Constantinople, and on the way back, he runs into Alexius Comnenus, who's doing the mop-up operations, and it's hopeless. They're trying to get Antioch. It's not going to work. They're probably destroyed already, so it's pointless. And then so he's like, oh, thanks for telling me. So then he goes back to Constantinople. And so the crusaders are, they eventually hear this and they're furious. And so they break their oath to the Byzantine Empire. It's like, all right, we're not going to give any more land back if we capture it. So that's why they took Antioch for themselves. And then you had Bohemond, who established the Principality of Antioch.
And he did that because he took the citadel of the city, right?
Well, there was...
I know that was a fight in Antioch of who got the citadel.
Yeah, that played a role. In fact, if you take a look read this chronicle, it increases the numbers by about tenfold. They said there were 60,000 people in the citadel. That's pretty much impossible. It was probably closer to 6,000. So he's the hero of Antioch. Bohemond takes the citadel, and then because of that, he essentially gets the city, and he's like, I'm done, I've got my thing. He's got his piece of the Eastern Roman Empire. Since he's a Norman, he's like, I'm happy with this, and he does not go to Jerusalem. He's finished with the crusade. And then eventually, this like 8 years later, but he actually goes to war with the Byzantine Empire and he loses and he becomes the vassal. In fact, if you read the Alexiad by Anna Comnena that I told you about a few minutes ago, she reproduces the text of the vassal contract he has to sign, and it is ugly. Oh man, it's humiliating.
Yeah, I think I recall, because that guy had a pretty sad life after the Crusades. Like he was kind of like this hero, and then he, I guess ego or trying to, I think it had to do with him trying to take over another territory in via secession or play a role in that or something like that. And it just, went downhill for him.
Yeah,
and then after Antioch, then you have like the relic thing that we kind of already talked about, to go to Jerusalem. They have another siege situation there, but it seems to, they learned their lesson. And I believe the most interesting aspect is that they were, they learned how to combat Greek fire on the wall defense. They learned how to do that. So, they were defended or it allowed them to take the wall of Jerusalem.
Well, a thing that, because like the whole time during the Crusades, they're sending letters back to and from the Pope and to and from other people in Europe. They had sent it to some Venetians. So Venetians send some supplies to the coast of Jerusalem, because keep in mind, Jerusalem is not on the coast, it's inland. So they get the supplies, and they use that supplies to make siege towers. And so and keep in mind, Jerusalem is a lot smaller than Antioch is. Like, it's important, obviously. It's an important city for Jews, Christians, and the Muslims. But it's not big like Antioch.
Doesn't it also have a mountain to give it cover?
Yeah, but they were able to make siege towers, so they were able to breach the walls quite easily. They didn't have that in Antioch. And so because of that, they're able to take the city. And on, I believe it's July 15th, 1099, that's the day they took Jerusalem and established a kingdom of Jerusalem. And then there's this debate who is going to be the king. And they said that no one should be called king because Christ is the king of Jerusalem. And And then eventually they came up with Kings, you know, so they were going to give it to Raymond of Toulouse, but he said no, so they ended up giving it to someone else.
Wasn't it Godfrey?
Godfrey Bouillon. Yeah.
Bouillon, yeah. So around this time, I don't know if it was in Antioch, there's a lot of shuffling of the deck because of all the feudal ties and stuff like that. So you had a bunch of people that had no ties to, you know, their lord, you know, was either dead or, you know, kind of went crazy or whatever. So, you know, who are we going to follow and be loyal to was kind of an issue, right? So they had to like shuffle, you know, each person had to like choose their lord, I guess, if they had zero, you know, hierarchy there.
Well, I know that Antioch was taken by like Bohemond. He was the, and there was a big question. Are they like a vassal of the Byzantine or like kind of a extension of the Byzantines, or are they a crusader state? And the truth is in, they exist till 1268, that they kind of do both. They're kind of a player in the region. They're kind of like a, almost a city state with its
vassal. But I guess my question is about how Antioch had a lot of casualties. Isn't that the city where they were? That's not the city where they, you know, there's cannibalism or anything like that. I think that was somewhere else, right? But
you're thinking of Alexandria on the Fifth Crusade, yeah?
No, somewhere on the First Crusade.
Okay, I know there was cannibalism in Alexandria on the Fifth Crusade.
Okay, but you're not as convinced on the First Crusade.
I don't know. I don't know offhand. I know by the time they had taken Antioch, they were like fresh out of supplies, but like they had supplies in Antioch, and then they're like, oh no, we've got this fresh army coming up. And then they kind of sneak attack the army, kind of preempt them. Cause I think the army thought they would have to fight a siege, but they attacked them on land and they were not expecting that. So they routed Kerbaga's forces there.
All right. So the First Crusade, someone ends at Ascalon. And there's like a more or less kind of a defeat at, I want to say Joppa or some other city, some coastal city. It just didn't work out with them trying to take that. But ultimately, what happened with Jerusalem as far as like the city goes? You know, the people talk about how many Christians and, or, you know, how many people were killed. Do we have any like stats on the figures? Or
we do actually. Now, again, it's this chronicle here, Chronicle of Fulcher of Chartres. He gives the number 10,000. Now, that number is problematic because all of his figures are
round,
are about 10 times higher than they should be. He said that the army that sieged Nicaea was 600,000. I promise you that's impossible. He said the Turkish army at the Battle of Aurelium was 380,000. I gave you the example of the citadel in Antioch, 60,000, probably about 10 times too high. And so I've done some Googling. It says in the temple, that was where it all culminated, there was a slaughter of 10,000 people there. However, the prayer capacity, so keep in mind, he exaggerates by about tenfold, and the prayer capacity of that building, it's the same building today. I looked it up online. It says about 1,500. And the Crusaders would have to be in there too, in addition to the Muslims. So it's probably like 1,000 there and probably like 1,000 throughout the city. Keep in mind, it's not a huge city. Because like if you go to Jerusalem today, there's like the old city, like the four quarters, the Jewish quarter, Muslim quarter. That's pretty much the size of the city. Like now you've got the Ottoman walls, but that was not even there. I believe like I've got a couple other primary sources. They don't give a I know the Jewish community was hurtled into the synagogue. They locked it up and set it on fire. Kind of an ugly episode there. But I think the only one that gives a figure of some sort is Folter of Chart. Robert the Monk doesn't give one. I don't think, I'm pretty sure that Albert of Aachen doesn't have one. Raymond of Aguilar doesn't have one. Ibn al-Kalanisi, that's an Islamic source, he doesn't have one. So like when people give a total, they normally say 10. Again, I've explained why that's problematic. It's probably much less. But and we don't have the raw figures, essentially. We got to make estimates.
All right. And a lot of history is filled with embellished numbers. Going back to Herodotus, who's kind of legendary for it. But
I think
I don't think he was doing 10x on what was plausible. So moving on, things don't exactly go well in the Second Crusade or the Little Crusade in between that. But let's kind of fast forward to the Fourth Crusade, which is kind of the more controversial. Actually, before that, what initiated the Third Crusade?
Okay, well, the Third Crusade.
What initiates the Second and the Third Crusade?
Okay, well, the Second Crusade's easy. That's the, like you talked about, the County of Edessa, the First Crusader state. That falls to an Islamic leader named Zengi, and he slaughters the people in there. So the Second Crusade is meant to go and get that land back. You had two kings. King Louis VII of France, and then there was the Holy Roman Emperor. I think it was Conrad. I apologize, I can't remember. But anyway, the Holy Roman Emperor, they essentially go into Anatolia again, and they don't have the same luck they had on the First Crusade. There's some French and the Germans in the Holy Roman Empire are forced back to Constantinople. Some French take a boat down to there, and basically King...
So they don't travel together.
No, they go separate. And there's kind of some interesting battles. Like there's this one where King Louis VII is in Anatolia. There's a river. The Turks are on the other side of a river. They're like following, just waiting for a spot where they can cross, and then they find a place where the water's shallow, and then they smash the Turks. It's kind of entertaining, that battle. And then eventually they get down to the Holy Land. They make some bad choices. They attack Damascus, who is an ally of theirs, because they're like, eventually Zengi is going to capture that.
So they're trying to preemptively capture what makes a man turn neutral, I guess.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they didn't get it, but then Zengi captured it, and so they got it anyway. And then what's interesting about the Second Crusade is the French king, King Louis VII, brought his wife on the crusade, and his wife was none other than Eleanor of Aquitaine. Have you heard of her?
Name rings a bell.
Okay. So, and then they get in a huge fight on the crusade, and then so as soon as they get back to Europe, she seeks a divorce or an annulment, and she gets married to King Henry II of England. And they produce a son. Well, they produce a few sons. Richard the Lionheart, and that's where the Third Crusade comes in. So the Second Crusade failed to restore the County of Edessa. But, you know, the Crusaders still had Jerusalem. They still had two other Crusader states, County of Tripoli, Principality of Antioch. So it's
so that Crusader states what initiates the Second Crusade.
Yeah.
And is that called for by the Pope, or is that more or less?
Pope called him. Yeah.
Okay. And then the Third Crusade is called by the Pope for what reason?
Well, in 1187, and this is covered in Kingdom of Heaven, if you, the Sultan Saladin, who is kind of overrated. He was not a good commander in army. He was good at diplomacy, but the Crusaders had beat Saladin several times, but then their king died and he got replaced by a king who's a very bad commander. He attacks Saladin. His army gets completely slaughtered. So they lose their army and he attacks Jerusalem and takes Jerusalem. So Jerusalem has fallen to the Muslims. Eventually the news gets back to the Pope and a crusade is called the Third Crusade, where it's the Super Bowl of Crusade. You had Saladin on one side, Richard the Lionheart, King Louis II of France, Frederick I, also known as Frederick Barbarossa, and King William of Sicily, but he essentially dies as soon as he gets there. But those three. Now, King Richard and King Louis II go by boat. King Frederick goes by land. And he drowns in a river, crossing a river. And a few of his army eventually do make it down to Acre, because Acre is the new capital after.
That's Jerusalem.
Yeah, and Saladin is sieging Acre. Well, he took Acre. Now the Crusaders are trying to siege it back. And so
I see.
What? Sorry.
By land or by sea?
At that point, it was only by land. Then eventually Richard arrives. He does a sea blockade as well. And at that point, they can no longer reinforce the city. Saladin does try to supply it by water, but Richard sunk his ships. And then they do manage to take the city. Now, a thing that James White talked about is, he slaughtered 2,700 men, you know, because the 2,700 soldiers who were defending Acre were taken. And basically, Richard told Saladin, I demand 200,000 of, I can't remember the currency they used, but 200,000 of that currency, and I'll free your men. And basically,
so he's ransoming.
Yeah, ransoming. And basically, they kept stalling. So basically, Saladin's like, oh, I need more time. And Richard put it off for a while, but eventually, he'd had enough. He's like, nope, you've had enough time. And he has all of them executed in plain sight.
I don't really see how that's. Yeah, I don't see how that's definitionally murder. I mean, they're prisoners of war, but at the same time, you're trying to ransom them. They're, you know, essentially hostages.
Yeah.
You know.
And like the thing James White does, like he'll talk about an ugly episode in the Crusades, but it's true that all war has ugly episodes. Like,
right.
I'm sure there's some wars he supports, and you can go into those wars and find ugly episodes where the good guys, the side that you're cheering for, although they're fighting the good fight, they do some stuff that's immoral. They kill civilians. They'll do things they shouldn't do. That happens in all war. I'm not saying it's good, but like I'm just saying, if you apply that standard, you better be a categorical pacifist. And I don't think James White is that.
Well, you're not allowed to fight wars that benefit Christians abroad. Yeah, maybe that's kind of the trend line.
it seems that way. He's got this kind of. In fact, I wrote on X today. I'm like, question: was it wrong for the Spanish to engage in the Reconquista? Because that was technically in Europe, but I mean, yeah, I'm sure some ugly things happened in those wars, you know. But I don't know that guy. He's starting.
So, but he seems to want to draw a delineation between, the Battle of Tours and the Siege of Antioch by means of the Crusades were not fighting for a nation or anything like that. Whereas, you know, Charlemagne was fighting for a nation and therefore it was legitimate, which I just think is inaccurate because, you know, first of all, they went in there fighting with the Byzantines. So they were an auxiliary force to, and yeah. you know, very special auxiliary force, but that's how it started. So by James White's own criterion, the Crusaders were actually a legitimate force. Now, when things go south, they're still there and they complete the mission. And then they set up Crusader states, which actually gives them more legitimacy by White's criteria of fighting for a standing or an established nation.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, it's true technically that the First Crusade was kind of a group of immersed. Yeah, and keep in mind at that time, you don't have like a nation like that's kind of like you don't really have nations in Europe. Like at that time, Count Raymond of Toulouse was more powerful than the King of France. Like that's how things were back then. Like if you go 200 years after that, yeah, the king is the most powerful man, but not at the time. Like it was a very different place in 1095 than it is in 2024.
Right. How does this Third Crusade end? This kind of confuses because it ends on diplomatic terms.
Yeah. But
it's not as decisive as say the other crusades.
Okay. Now the Third Crusade, I talk about how they capture Acre and then they capture some coastal settlements all the way down to Jaffa. Richard defeats Saladin a few times. He doesn't attack Jerusalem. There was some debate why he didn't attack Jerusalem. Like historians debate that, but like they say he was powerful because he had a big navy. So on the coast he's strong, but if he goes inland, he no longer has his navy. So he can be outflanked because in the Third Crusade, the Crusader army was smaller than the Islamic army, but their soldiers were better. So that compensated it. So if he's inland, he can get outmaneuvered by the larger army. Anyway, there's a lot of theories. Point is, he doesn't attack Jerusalem, but he restores a lot of coastal land. And they end with the Treaty of Jaffa signed in, I believe, September of 1192. And it's a 3-year truce. And 6 months after the truce, Saladin, he dies and his empire kind of falls apart. You know, there's factional struggles and like his kids and his brother tries to steal it from his kids. It's kind of a, there's kind of a thing where he takes a knife, he dips his knife in poison, and he cuts off a piece of apple with the, he's like, oh, have some apple, you know, trying to poison Saladin's kids, poor guy. But the point is, yes, it ends in a truce, and then you don't have any crusades after that for a while.
And then we have 1204. What was the initial inspiration for that? Because I know the goal was to take Egypt.
Yeah,
so they thought that Egypt with the, you know, basically supplies and logistics, you take out Egypt. Not only is Egypt rich, or if properly administered, it's rich. It's also necessarily for taking the Holy Land.
Yeah, Richard the Lionheart on the Third Crusade had floated that idea around, but it didn't come to fruition. But it seemed like a popular idea. And the whole reason Richard had to stop his crusade was because the King of France had already gone back stealing his land in France. So he had to go. So he left it unfinished. But Pope Innocent III calls the Third Crusade in 1198. I believe it was the 15th of August on the Feast of the Assumption, which we just passed. Richard the Lionheart was actually supposed to lead the Fourth Crusade. He was still alive at the time, but a few months later, he's killed in a siege. He got hit by an arrow, and his surgeon probably could have saved him, but he screwed up, and it became gangrene, and that was the end of Richard. The question is, who is going to lead the crusade? And it starts to crystallize around a group of French knights at a tournament in Champagne. They the papal preachers in town preaching the crusade, and they're like, this sounds good, except in Champaign. And for all those who want, if you go to 1peter5.com, I've written a 5,000-page page article on the Fourth Crusade. I put in the private chat. Perhaps you can share it. I use primary sources. There's a couple scholars quoted in there, but that's the editor put that in. I don't like quoting modern scholars. Okay, but getting back, so like, and these French knights are from Champaign. That's not on the coast. So these people, sorry, not 5,000 words. Sorry.
I mean, it was still, it might have been believable either way, but there's a lot that could be said about 1204. They meet in Italy. I forget whether it was immediately Venice or whether they met in like Milan or Florence first and then moved to Venice.
They tried going to Genoa and Pisa,
according
to one chronicle, and tried to contract the fleet there. And they're like, you're asking for too much. We can't do that. But then they go to Venice and they tell them how much they need. And they're like, yeah, we can take care of that. And so at that time, the crusade is being... still being preached in Europe. So they'll be like, so their plan is to get 33,000. They're kind of making an estimate that 33,000 people will show up and 4,500 horses. That's how much they told the Venetians they needed. They gave them the price. They're like, okay, we'll kind of set it. So when each crusader comes, we're expecting 33,000. It's about 100,000. So each one will pay $3 of the current. I don't know what currency they had, but it's of the currency they used. But unfortunately, only a third of the crusaders, a third of the people they think are going to show up. And so they have to pay extra, and they can only come up
to pay the full freight.
Yeah. And they can only come up with about half the cash. And so they're like, so the Doge of Venice, that's the guy in charge of Venice.
Yeah.
Doge.
Like the digital, like the cryptocurrency.
Yeah. So he says, okay, until you can pay the rest, you got to go attack the city of Zara, which is the modern day city of Zadar in Croatia. Back then it was part of the Kingdom of Hungary. So they didn't really have a choice, so they're like, okay, let's go. So they take the fleet, sack Zara. And not only was Zara a Christian city, the king of Hungary was under a crusader vow. So not only have they attacked Christians, they attacked fellow crusaders. And so the Pope excommunicates the entire crusade. He's furious.
Right. It was basically unsanctioned from that point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, the French send an envoy to the Pope saying, look...
I know it changes, but, you know, the Pope didn't condone their actions.
Yeah, the Pope was not happy. The Pope was not happy. The French send an envoy to patch things up with the Pope, so they got their excommunication removed, but the Venetians did not. So they stayed excommunicated. However, at that point, a new player comes into the game, Alexius Angelus,
he's a claimant to the emperor in Constantinople.
Yeah, his dad had been Isaac II, who was actually the Byzantine emperor during the Third Crusade. But then his brother named Alexius, so the evil uncle, also named Alexius. There's too many Alexiuses in this story, so bear with me here. You have the young Alexius, who's with the Crusaders, and then the his uncle, who has overthrown his father and thrown him in prison, and he's fled the empire, so he's in Western Europe trying to find an army. So he comes across the Crusaders. He's like, you guys are out of cash? Okay, I'll pay you 200,000 pieces of silver. which is more than enough to cover all your debts and then some. I'll join the crusade myself. I'll reunite the churches. I'll make the patriarch submit to the Pope. He basically gives a whole bunch of promise. I think the crusaders only had the cash in mind, but either way. So the crusaders are kind of like, well, I guess we don't have a choice. Then they tell the Pope. The Pope's kind of like, okay, we'll see where this goes, you know. And so then they send forth to Constantinople. And then they come across the bad Alexius. Alexius III is like, okay, and then he tries to smooth things over. He's like, oh, we'll give you some supplies on your way to the Holy Land, you know, just kind of get out of here. You know, he tries to be polite and diplomatic, but the crusaders aren't having it. The French knights get out front of the land walls in Constantinople. The Venetian ships go into the Golden Horn, which is the body of water that separates Constantinople from
the river
Galata. And so then they start to siege the city, and the Venetians manage to mount the wall and set 25 or 27 towers on fire. And at this point, the people in the city start to panic, including the Emperor Alexius. He decides to flee the city at night, but
not before he takes everything.
Yeah, he takes as much cash as he can. And remember that the cash was one of the promises to the crusaders. So at that point, they drag the old frail Isaac II out of the dungeon. He opens up the gates. The crusaders and Alexius come in, and Alexius IV is crowned co-emperor with his father. And then in February of... Oh, and his father agrees to pay it. They told him about the agreement. He's like, this is a huge amount of money, but you've done us a huge service, so we're going to pay you. So,
yeah, it's not like he has much of a choice.
Yeah, they didn't have much of a choice.
But, now, did they blind Isaac II?
Well, his...
I know they had a history of blinding people to...
His brother... Well, he was already blind at this point because his brother had blinded him when he threw him in the dungeon. And his son, Alexius, had fled, so he didn't get blinded. But, well, yeah.
I'm not sure if that's like an Eastern Orthodox thing that you can't rule if you're blind or...
Yeah, it was kind of like a Roman thing. And so basically... And he dies not long after this. He dies, I believe, in February of 1204 of old age. So now Alexius IV is ruling on his own. And he pays half the money to the crusaders. They're waiting for more, you know. But eventually, and so then eventually the people in Constantinople are just furious. They're like, you've brought this foreign army there. You've paid them a bunch of our money. They're not happy. So at that point, there's a guy in the city of Constantinople named Mordzophilus. Now, Mordzophilus was his nickname. His real name was Alexius. I know a lot of Alexiuses. So he kills Alexius IV, and he's crowned Alexius V. And he hates the crusaders. He's like, I'm not paying them another penny. And so the crusaders... so he sends out an army to attack the crusaders on land, but he's...
That doesn't work.
He repelled, yeah. Like, they got nothing on the French knights. And then... and the then...
Bold strategy.
Yeah, and so then on the 12th of April, 1204, they siege the walls... of the city from the Golden Horn. And then they go and open the door. The French knights come in. And believe it or not, there's not a lot of people killed. But the city was looted to the nines. Like, all the relics were taken too. All the gold in the churches was taken. Because they had to pay themselves now. So they looted everything. It's funny because now you go out west. If you've ever been to Venice, remember half these are Venetian, these crusaders. If you go to St. Mark's square, you see the cathedral there. They got these bronze horses. Those were from Constantinople.
Right.
If you go to the Vatican, you can see the relics of St. John Chrysostom. Well, how come the relics of St. John Chrysostom are at the Vatican, right? Again, Fourth Crusade, you know, that you got relics of all these Greek saints in Western Europe now. And that's how the Shroud of Turin got taken to Western Europe. So they essentially rule Constantinople until 1261. And until it's taken back by Michael the Eighth, and he's an interesting character.
So I kind of view this, you know, Fourth Crusade. There's treachery basically on all sides, and you know, Alexios the Fourth, I didn't really view as a good guy, but you're also saying Alexios the Fifth was probably even worse, and you know, the evil uncle Alexios was. You know, let me just cash out.
Whatever
happened to him?
Well, the thing is, there's Alexius the Third, and then Alexius the Fifth, who was the one who attacked the Crusaders, and who was the leader when the Crusaders attack. He flees. So you have two claimants to the emperor, kind of out there wandering around. They eventually join forces together. Alexius the Third and Alexius the Fifth, and they're like, let's band together, put our forces together to try to take back Constantinople from the French. And then he's like, okay. Then Alexius the Third backstabs Alexius the Fifth, has him blinded. So then he's walking around the countryside blind. He's picked up by a patrol of Crusaders, and he's taken back to Constantinople. They take him to the top of the pillar and throw him off. And kill him. So that's the end of Alexius V. And Alexius III, he stays out there, but I think he dies in like 1215, around there.
So your thoughts, you know, I've never really viewed the Byzantines from being able to recover from 1204. Certainly when the Ottomans kind of came up, you know, there was just no victories to be found. Like, they couldn't negotiate their way out of. They couldn't even, you know, Ottomans would not honor peace treaties or marriage alliances or anything like that. So, you know, they don't really recover from this. It just kind of all goes downhill.
Well, the Ottomans were formed in the late 1200s. That's after they had Constantinople back. At this time, there's a whole bunch of Turkish states in Anatolia.
Right.
But a third of Anatolia at this time, in 1300, if you go to 1300, they still have a large footing in Anatolia, the Byzantines. And then eventually, once the Ottomans start to expand and absorb a whole bunch of more of the smaller Turkish states, they got stronger and stronger. And then eventually, they're able to attack. They start taking away the land in Anatolia. And I think in 1337 is when they capture the last of the Byzantine land in Anatolia. So I think it was independent of the Fourth Crusade. In fact, I got a quote in that 5,000 word article I wrote. I got a quote by a 15th century Greek historian named Critovoulos. It says all of the inhabitants were unarmed and unmolested. Then, having overthrown the tyranny and recovered itself, the city regained its former state and was a seat of the empire again, ruling over many races in Asia and Europe, and not a few islands. It became splendid and rich and glorious and famed, a ruler and an example in all good things, the center of learning, culture, and wisdom and virtue, in fact, of all the best things in one. So it sounds like after they got it back, things became pretty good again. So I personally think the two events are independent. One didn't affect the other, based on my reading of the sources.
Okay. That's a pretty interesting perspective. That I hadn't really considered, because, again, I just kind of view it, you know, from, you know, there's ups and downs, but the trend line has been down for centuries at this point.
Yeah. It had been down overall, but in that down, there's ups and downs, you know, if that makes
sense. Right. Yeah, you know, like a stock market portfolio that's just going down rather than up over time.
Yeah.
It's kind of how it was. So that, you know, those are the four major crusades. I kind of wanted to flip over and talk about the, you know, the Northern Europe crusades, because, you know, I know that they tried to argue in order to recruit knights that, hey, these are just as valid as the Holy Land crusades. How much do you know about these crusades?
Well, I don't have a lot of primary source knowledge on these crusades, because it's really hard to find primary sources on this stuff, but I got some secondary stuff. Like, those crusades were usually, because the church would send priests up there to do missionary work, yeah. But then they would get killed, and so then this news would reach the church, and then they'd call them to do that. So it was essentially to protect the priests who were getting killed up there. Now, again, I don't know a lot about those crusades because they're really hard to find information on. Like, I'm really trying to find it. But I think Albert of Aachen might have a bit on it. But, like, it's not the main point. He talks about the crusades in the Holy Land. Another thing about the crusades, it's the... although the crusader states fall in the 1290s, you still have crusades that are called against the Turks, Crusade of Varna, Crusade of Nicopolis, because they were still trying to, like, encroach on the last area of the Byzantine Empire. Because keep in mind, in 1337, they had lost all of Anatolia, but they still have Constantinople and part of Europe, and then the Turks get across, start taking land in Thrace, the Peloponnese, like basically modern-day Greece. So in 1396, they send the Crusade of Nicopolis. That fails. 1444, Crusade of Varna. That fails. 1453, on the 29th of May, is that sad Tuesday when they Constantinople falls to the Turks, extinguishing the last remnant of the Christians in the East, of Christian control in the East. There's still Christians in the East, but they're under Islamic domination.
So right before that, you have the Council of Florence, where, you know, I guess the East and the West kind of try to get together. And there, I guess there is talk of there being a crusade during that time. That didn't get anywhere. So what ended up happening? Because the Council of Florence is like 1440s or maybe late 30s.
Yeah, it's about 1440. And then they basically pronounce a union. You still had John the Eighth Palaiologos as the emperor. And he's at the council. And he basically tells his bishops to sign, you know. And all but one sign. So they proclaim the union.
Which one was the holdout? Was it the Russians?
No, they signed. It was Mark of Ephesus who was the holdout.
Okay.
There were two holdouts. Cardinal Metropolitan Bessarion was an opponent of the union, but he switched sides. And he stayed Catholic until the day he died, too, actually. But Mark of Ephesus stayed against the union until the day he died. And he kind of like... pretty much the only place it has any traction is Constantinople. That's because the emperor's enforcing it. And it's like, hey, we're part of the Catholics now. Crusade, please. Let's go, you know, against the Turk, you know. And they had the Crusade of Varna, and that failed. And
that was in like Hungary,
Hungary-ish. I believe it's in modern day Bulgaria.
Okay, but this is the one where the Frankish knights kind of blundered and got a little too ahead of themselves or something like that. Burgundian knights, I should probably say. I'm pretty sure.
Well, I believe this crusade was mainly Poles and Wallachians. Is Romanian.
Yeah, Romanian.
Yeah. And they get annihilated at Varna, sold off as slaves. Ton of them are executed, very ugly. And then, basically, Constantine the the 11th, that's the brother of John the 8th, takes over in 1448 when he dies, and he appeals to Rome. He becomes Catholic. He's like, okay, I'm implementing the Union. And it took forever for troops to get there. They finally sent some in September of 1452. They know that the Ottomans are preparing an attack. And so their Pope, it's like, we can't wait any longer. We need troops. Now, it's not really the Pope's fault, because in 1453, the huge event that happened in 1453, apart from the fall of Constantinople, is the end of the Hundred Years' War. So the French and English are busy fighting each other. Yeah. The Spanish are in the last stage of the Reconquista. They can't help. Pretty much everyone in Europe was busy doing something else.
I mean, the Italian wars are on the horizon, right?
Yeah, no, like, they're completely fracturing. Yeah, that's true. They're fracturing in southern and central Italy. Eventually, they send about 300 archers, and they're like, that's all you get. And then they're like, okay, well, that's better than nothing. Then they proclaim the Union in Hagia Sophia in December of 1452. And then they... they try to defend the city. It's a very long siege, but ultimately it became a Turkish city on May 29th.
All right. We have a question about the Crusades against the Hussites. So I've always wanted to know more about that. You got the probably one of the greatest of the Czech military minds in that crusade, or, you know, leading the Hussites.
Yeah, Jan
Žižek. Yeah, and he was a Cyclops, so I guess that's pretty fun.
Yeah, he eventually got blinded in his second eye, too. Like for a while, he was a Cyclops, but then he...
And he was pretty good, you know, being a blind commander.
Yeah, like he'd have... It's like they're attacking our left flank. He's like, all right, send this to reinforce. Yeah, no, he was quite the leader. Now, the thing about the Hussites, I've got a ton of primary sources on them, but I've not reread a lot. I'll tell you the things I know. There's some good secondary sources on them. There's a historian who writes about them named Thomas Fudge. He's collated a lot of the primary sources too. I got them over there. I can see them. And pretty much what happened is, yes, they crusade against the Hussites, and then they defeat them. John Hus and Jerome are executed. But then the thing that's interesting is what happens next. That is when everyone cuts it off, the whole thing with the Hussites. But the thing about the Hussites that don't know is what happened next. They fractured into a million different groups, and then the church helped one group, kind of like a group that was powerful and wasn't too offensive to Catholic doctrine. And then they eventually collate them all into one, and then they kind of like agree to a treaty, and then 30 years later they break the treaty. Again, I'm not too well read on that. I do have to get to that, though.
So I thought John Hus died before much of the crusading against them happened, and then that's where you have
Yeah, he was burnt at the Council of Constance, or shortly after the Council of Constance, by the local king of Hungary. I'm not trying to say church was involved. The church fully endorsed his burning. They had to launch the Crusades, and then they eventually capture it, and then they have Jerome executed. He lasted a bit longer. Of course, he tries to recant. He kind of has a moment where he's like... he's like Thomas Cranmer, you know. He's kind of tries to denounce the faith to save his life, and then he realizes they're going to kill him anyway. So then he goes back. So that was probably some of the later crusades. You've got the Battle of Lepanto in 1571. That was a crusade. I believe the Polish winged Hussars at Vienna in 1680. 9 was sanctified as a crusade, and I believe that was the last crusade ever called. Unless you want to include Indiana Jones in the last crusade. So
now, interesting, if we kind of fast forward through European history, there are a lot of additional wars that have religious overtones. Russo-Turkish wars seem to definitely have, from an Eastern Orthodox perspective, you know, they might be crusades in the East, because, you know, ultimately they wanted, you know, Russian Orthodoxy to be helmed at Constantinople for the prestige.
Yeah.
They didn't quite get that. And some have called, the Crimean War the last crusade, which is kind of an interesting.
I think for the crusade, you have to have like the Pope sanctified as a crusade. Right. You have two episodes in Byzantine history where it's kind of like a holy war. The emperor declares a holy war. Basically, Emperor Heraclius did that in the 7th century against the Persians. The second one was Emperor Manuel Comnenus, who was the grandson of Alexius Comnenus, who appealed to the Pope for the First Crusade. He tries to launch a holy war in 1176, kind of like a crusade. And it ended in the Battle of Nyírcephalon in 1176, where he was essentially trying to drive the Turks out of Anatolia, and he failed. So you kind of have some equivalence over there because their church worked a bit differently. Like back then, until 1453, the emperor functioned kind of like the Pope did in the West. It's not a perfect analogy, but there's a lot of similarity. They're like the monarch over the church. The Eastern Orthodox are not going to agree with that, but I've got sources.
I mean, one of my criticisms of Eastern Orthodoxy is I don't think it's very compatible for effective state government. That, you know, because they didn't really have secession. You know, you can't just, you know, rebel against the rightful ruler for no reason, which seemed very common in Eastern, that in the East compared to in the West, there was a lot more security with secession, even if there's disputes, in my opinion.
Well,
and
the thing that kind of screwed the pooch with the Eastern Orthodox Church is they didn't have an investiture controversy, which completely separated church and state in the 11th century in Western Europe. In fact, Pope Urban II, who called the First Crusade, he was part of the investiture controversy. Like at that time, things were going well in the, but under Gregory the VII, he had to turn things around. But that didn't happen in the East, in the Byzantine Empire. So you have things like the guy who takes back Constantinople from the Crusaders, Emperor Michael the VIII. He got excommunicated by the Patriarch. This is unprecedented. This is the only time, as far as I know, this has ever happened. But the Patriarch saw him, he blinded a kid so he couldn't succeed him. And he's like, I'm excommunicating you. And so what happens is Patriarch Arsenius, who excommunicates him, is replaced by a guy named Joseph. And he's like, all right, Joseph, I want you to undo my excommunication. He's like, all right, boom, done. You're back in the church. And then that split the patriarchal line into a bit of a schism, because there was the Josephites and Arsenites, because they're like, how can an excommunicated emperor appoint a patriarch? So that means Arsenius is still the true patriarch. And so it had two patriarchal lines for a while. And then eventually Michael the VIII wanted to implement the Union of Lions. This is the first union. And he's like, all right, Joseph, I got my union in France. I want you to implement the union. He's like, I don't do that. I don't believe in the unions. He's like, all right, Joseph's gone. And so they put John echoes in, and now you have three streams: the Unionists, the Josephites, and Arsenites. It was game of patriarchal thrones almost. Yeah.
Now, speaking of like a game of patriarchal thrones, you recently did a video on, you know, the papists having their own Game of Thrones, right? Yeah. The conclave.
Yeah.
And you take a side against Avignon.
Yes. Yes, I do.
So
what did you think of that, by the way, the video I did?
I haven't gotten around to watching it, but it was on my to-do list. But I just saw that. I'm like, wow. Cause because as a Protestant, it's like, you know, you look at some of the claims that the Catholics say about their faith, and it's like, I kind of think that events like this kind of undermine the historic, the apostolic succession argument, I guess. So I was curious that you took a stand against the Avignon papacy. So I was definitely interested in learning more about that.
Well, and keep in mind, when I say Avignon, I mean not Avignon from 1309 to 1379. Because that was the Pope, for a long reason I won't get into, the Pope had moved from Rome to Avignon. So the Pope was they essentially in 1308 or 9, I can't remember the exact year, they elect a bishop in France as Pope, and he was in France when he was elected, and he's making his way down to Rome, but he's taking care of a bunch of stuff in France first, and then he does not ever get to Rome. But by then he's elected a whole bunch of new cardinals, so they're French cardinals, so they elect the new French guy, and he stays in France, and then he puts more cardinals, and I know it's a huge black eye. Eventually they go back to Rome, and then they had a conclave because the Pope I believe it's Gregory the 11th.
He's the one that resigned, right?
No. Okay. That was, that's the end of the schism. So like they come from Avignon, they go back to Rome. Papacy's back in Rome. Then the people in Rome are kind of rowdy. They're like, don't even try to think of leaving. We want a Roman or at least Italian Pope. And so they elect an Italian Pope, Archbishop of Bari. And he goes and he stays as Pope. And then a lot of the French cardinals don't like his policies. They see what he's doing, and then they don't like his policies. And then so they secretly elect their own Pope, and they go back to Avignon. And they claim that the first conclave was under duress because of the angry mob outside. But they only make that claim after the fact.
Once they,
according to the source.
After they're safe.
Yeah, yeah. According to the source I quote, they elected their own pope, not because they thought it was duress, but because they didn't like the policies he was doing. They just used the duress claim as an excuse. So that whole line that goes to Avignon from 1378 to 1414 is a fake line. And I quote the 14th century source.
All right. Where can people learn more about your stuff? I mean, I made allusions to your channel. It's linked in the description below.
Yeah, it's Alan Ruhl. Just type Allan space Ruhl and you'll find it in no time. I do a lot of church history stuff. You could probably tell by this, I like the primary sources. And the Crusades are a big part. In fact, I started reading the Byzantine Emperor, about the Byzantine Empire. I started reading the primary sources because of my Fourth Crusade studying, because I read a Greek account of a guy in Constantinople. And that chronicle goes from 1118, the year Alexius Comnenus dies, all the way up to 1207. So then I read a whole bunch. Then I read the Alexiad and started binging those sources. So yeah, like I'm the primary source guy. And that's how I like to learn all of my history. Because a lot of modern historians are so biased. They hate the church. And I think James White, to kind of tie this all up, James White like, oh yeah, I teach your chip. His stuff is from secondary sources. Like I can tell just by listening to his stuff. Cause like, I think there's a guy who cataloged like 60 or 70 of his classes.
Is one of those secondary sources, Kingdom of Heaven?
No, I don't
think that's that. A joke, because that wouldn't be second, that wouldn't even count as secondary, but
no, that's the I think he reads a lot of Schaff and like a bunch of modern stuff, you know, like it, when he debated Sungenis on transubstantiation, like pretty much all he did was quote modern Protestant historians. Oh, all these guys agree with me. It's like, well, and I know you're an evangelical. I know you don't believe in transubstantiation, but I mean, right. are you going to quote, hey, the modern Protestant historians agree with me? Like, is that going to convince me? No, you know, but so.
So I have a book. It's called Christian History Made Easy. It was like the first Christian history book that I got a long time ago. But I read it now and I'm like, yeah, there's definitely some inaccuracies here. I'm much more of a fan of Constantine, as you might be able to tell, than a lot of people in Baptist circles might be. I don't think Christians had it better under Julian the Apostate, which the book claims. And like, that's, I think that's an absurd claim.
Very absurd.
So I don't really. You know, and it does try to say, you know, maybe the Montanists weren't that bad and stuff like that. So I just, there's some things in that book that I just didn't, you know, does not age well. And I kind of view the Anabaptists as overall the bad guys, but in the Protestant Reformation. So we got some questions from the audience. This one is kind of interesting because Raven Ibrahim has written a very popular book on the Crusades. I don't know if you've read it. And if you have any thoughts to share on it.
I've not read the book. Again, I try to stick to primary sources. But let me recommend a book. If you want an overview of the Crusades. Okay, there's two books I'm going to recommend. If you want like an overview of the Crusades by a modern historian who's not some rabid anti-Crusades person. Your best bet is The New Concise History of the Crusades by Thomas Madden. In fact, I've had some email correspondence with Thomas Madden. There's a history of the expedition to Jerusalem by Fulcher of Chartres. This is the first crusade, and the crusader states up to 1124. And there's actually one more book I want to recommend. It's published by Penguin. This book is $24 in Canada. I'm in Canada, so I don't know how much that is in American money, maybe like 18 or something.
20-ish.
Yeah, so it's called Chronicles of the Crusades. Jean Joinville and Geoffroy de Villehardouin. These are a chronicle of the Fourth Crusade. That's a very, very good chronicle, Geoffroy de Villehardouin. In fact, if you read that 5,000-word essay I wrote, I quote him a few times. And Joinville is the 7th and 8th Crusade with King Louis the Ninth, St. Louis. So, yeah, that's who you want to read. And if you want more, just send me a private thing on X, and I'll tell you what to read depending on what you're interested in.
All right. Y'all might ask, how did the Islamic State go from an equal threat to a laughingstock in war that we know today? I mean, if I wanted to take a crack at it, I don't think they didn't adapt to naval, you know, ships advancements, you know, going from galleys to, you know, mast ships. They didn't adapt to technological changes, Europeans, firearms, stuff like that.
So basically the last great Islamic empire that posed a threat to the West is the Ottoman Empire. And by about 1700, they're well past their prime. They're no longer a significant threat. Their empire is shrinking at that point.
They're kind of viewed as a carcass to, devour and split.
Yeah, like,
but you can't split it too much because balance of power was like the main geopolitical thought of the day. We have to maintain the balance of power.
Yeah, and that actually plays a role after the First World War in the creation of the Republic of Turkey. Like that, like the Republic of Turkey is actually what ended the Ottoman Empire. Like they call it they sometimes call it a successor state. And I'm like, not really. They kind of squashed them. So they've essentially fallen into. All right, we got any more questions?
Last one appears to be, did the Pope try to get Avignon back to the Congress of Vienna in 1815? I don't know this one.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know for sure. It makes sense. The Pope at that time would have been Pius the Sixth or Seventh. I think Seventh. I don't know if the Pope was at the Congress of Vienna. Like, my knowledge of European history starts to fall off at around like the English Civil War with Cromwell and Charles I getting his head chopped off, Charles II, and then the Jacobite uprisings and all that stuff. But I'm trying to remedy this, but I'm more of a guy who studies from about 800 to 1300-1400. That's my prime area.
All righty. Good questions. So if you like this kind of content, do subscribe to the channel, to the podcast if you are new, and smash that like button on your way out. My new book, Winning Not Winsome, 10 Commandments of Spiritual Warfare, is out. If you liked Megan Basham's book, or you liked Andrew Isker's book, A Boniface Option, I think this book is very much in your wheelhouse. It's very much a practical application of what to do in the times that we are in. You know, we just need to make very small adjustments or consciously act out, you know, what we've already been doing. And that's kind of a rundown of what the Ten Commandments are, what they do. I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel or anything. But it is new content. Like, I've never done like videos on what's in the book. So I think that's all the more reason to get it, because, you know, I don't like listening to, you know, if I watch someone and they write a book on the material that they've already done videos or whatever on, I, you know, odds of me finishing that book pretty low, but this is not that. So anyway, that's all I got for today. We will catch you on the next one. Stay based, Christ is King, and have a blessed night.